This episode of Access Utah was first broadcast in March 2019.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Michelle Anderson says, I'm what you might call a homecomer. Wendell Berry, the Kentucky writer and farmer, uses that word to describe people who have spent some time away, usually to pursue better opportunities in cities, and then choose to return to their rural roots. A recent opinion piece in the New York Times is headlined, Go Home to Your Quote-Unquote Dying Hometown. Michelle Anderson says, I did, and it isn't what I expected. I'm more involved in social and racial justice, economic development, and feminism than I ever was in the big city. Michelle Anderson is a writer, musician, and arts advocate. She is the Rural Program Director for Springboard for the Arts, an economic and community development organization for artists in Minnesota. She and her husband live in Fergus Falls, Minnesota, population 14,000. Michelle Anderson, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Appreciate you taking the time to be with us. So I encountered your piece in the New York Times, resonated with me. I'm from a small town, and I couldn't wait to get out of Vernal in eastern Utah. But, you know, as the years go on, I could see myself going back if the opportunity presented itself. So it resonated with me, and I think many people in Utah have those rural roots. And then you sent some stuff yesterday. I had totally missed, I guess, the genesis of this article, which is strange and weird and very interesting. Just a nutshell, and then we can expand upon this. A writer for Der Spiegel, German publication, one of their big publications, essentially fabricated an article, right, about your hometown.
That's right.
So this, and I want to read your sort of annoyed and angry couple of paragraphs from a piece in the Medium, in Medium.com, in response to this, quoting Michelle Anderson. I know I'm not the only rural advocate and citizen who is wary about the anthropological gaze on rural America in the wake of 2016 elections and has struggled with how or whether to respond to the sudden attention and questions when before we really didn't matter to mass media at all. Suddenly we do matter, but only because everyone wants to be the hero pundit that cracks the code of the current rural psyche. There are only two things those writers seem to have concluded or able to pitch to their editors. We are either backwards, living in the past, or we're like dumb, endearing animals that just need attention in order to keep us from eating the rest of the world alive. and that does, I mean, that resonates with me. That seems to be, you know, the hordes of media went out after the 2016 election. It does seem to kind of fall into one of those two camps.
It really does, yeah. It's been an interesting few years, and I first moved back to my rural roots in 2011, so, you know, I didn't really see all of this coming, and I definitely didn't see myself getting wrapped up in a international media scandal or getting to share my own homecoming story, but I am finding that I'm not alone, that there are a lot of people that are, that don't fit into the kind of monolithic narratives of rural people, and so a lot of us are just trying to work really hard to navigate those narratives and try to tell a more nuanced story.
So this article in Der Spiegel, this particular journalist, used that in quotes, I guess, in this case, went beyond this kind of this forced narrative. He actually mm-hmm. fabricated facts, made up quotes, made up people. What do you think the impulse was there, getting his mind a little bit?
Well, it's hard to... So the story he wrote about Fergus Falls was one of at least a dozen that he fabricated for Der Spiegel, so it wasn't just... We weren't the only, you know, victims of his lies. When it was exposed that he had fabricated all these articles. One was about like a Syrian orphanage. Another was about a woman that travels around the United States to witness death sentence executions. He confessed and admitted that he had been feeling pressured to sort of tell a certain story that he thought his editors wanted and that the readers of Der Spiegel wanted. So, and he kind of admitted that he maybe had some mental health issues. So so it's hard to kind of understand, and it's very surreal that, you know, to wake up one day and see your little town kind of wrapped up in this, in one of the biggest European media scandals in history. When he came here, he told some of the folks that he interviewed that he wanted to just learn more about a community that had voted mostly for Trump, and that's definitely, you know, that's true. Our county went about 60% Trump, and so he wanted to just sort of tell a classic American story, and he could have done that. He spent a good 4 weeks here, which is really luxurious for a journalist assignment to be able to really get in the community and get to know people. He was invited into people's homes. He attended some community events, but for some reason that is really hard to understand, he chose to really just spend his time taking photos that would support a completely made-up story. He kind of combined different personalities in our community. He portrayed our city administrator as this young virgin who had never seen the ocean, that carries around a gun, all of those which are not true. He said things like our movie theater had been playing American Sniper for a good like 2 or 3 years because we were so obsessed with it, which we quickly confirmed was not true with our movie theater owner. it's just my friend and I, when this article first came out, we wanted to do something to push back on what this guy had done to our community, but we had no idea that, 6 months later he would get fired from Der Spiegel for doing this to many, many communities, and so we just happened to kind of be in the right place at the right time with our own rebuttal and wrote this kind of, just kind of playful, kind of mad response, and it went viral. So for whatever reason, people just really enjoyed seeing two kind of everyday citizens that aren't even journalists kind of fight back against these bigger entities. So it was vindicating.
Yeah, that must have felt good. And so these, you know, a lot of this article was fabricated, and is part of you know, his pattern of fabrication. He's been caught and fired, presumably. But it's interesting that it he's just sort of tweaking the narrative. He's taking it to 11, right? But the narrative is there that the competent journalists go out on these anthropological trips. And it seems like they're looking for a narrative. You're saying that the reality of rural America is more complex, more nuanced.
Definitely. I chose to move here to Fergus Falls when I was 29. So I'm kind of, I moved here from Portland, Oregon, because in Portland, I just didn't feel right to me. I really missed my rural roots, and I wanted to make a bigger impact than I could really feel was happening in Portland. And when I moved here, I learned that I sort of thought that I was kind of rebellious, but when I moved here, I learned that there are all kinds of people like me that are sort of looking for a different path and a deeper connection to place. And so I actually met quite a few younger creative people in town that were just doing really amazing, thoughtful, innovative work and thinking about just how rural communities can thrive, how we can kind of think of the shifts in economy right now as an opportunity to explore explore new models and just kind of, because many of these people that are returning to small towns have lived in cities, there's also kind of just some really great conversations happening about urban-rural reciprocity or solidarity. So I'm not going to be shy about admitting that I'm a pretty diehard liberal and a feminist, and so there have been challenges because this community is really conservative, but those challenges have made me a better person and a more just better at kind of trying to listen and understand and build empathy across these divides that are so prevalent in our country right now.
I wonder if you could follow. I'm interested in that. You come from you lived for quite a few years there in Portland, a liberal town, right? Yep. I guess you'd fit into the local color there, and then you return to you go to Fergus Falls. Trump vote there was about 60%, I think you say.
Something like that, yeah.
Something like that. But you do have conversations, do you, across the divide? Are there uncomfortable conversations? How do those conversations happen? And I guess my perception of a rural place is you maybe kind of have to have those conversations more than you could kind of hide in an urban setting. But rural, everybody maybe would know what your leanings are. Well, you'd maybe have those conversations more? I don't know.
That's a good question. I mean, I think that more so than having questions about kind of the national landscape of politics, I think that there's a really interesting experience here where you know that you don't agree politically with somebody, but you live in the same place, you care about its future, and, you know, so it's really more about the local politics and just sort of getting over those differences because you have the same hopes and fears for your community's health and the children that are growing up here. I would say we don't talk a lot about the presidential elections because I think that's just it's too hard. It's hard to get anywhere with that conversation, but we will have, you know, pretty heated debates about, an upcoming library referendum and that's where I think just knowing that we can kind of put those bigger ideological differences aside to sort of navigate what's right in the everyday for our local future. Just to kind of give an example, the night of the 2016 election, there was our mayor owns a brewery and a pizza place, and so he was actually running for mayor at the time, so he was one of the candidates, and the pizza place was packed with people from I think you know every spectrum on the political scale, but really we were all there to watch the mayoral race and the city council race and. There was a ballot measure about our library on there, and I think it's kind of fascinating that was as Trump was getting elected that was just sort of in the background amidst all the really more immediate everyday things. But I will say that the other piece about kind of moving here. In Portland, it was really easy to kind of find my people. So, you know, I was a musician. I worked at a music school, so all of my friends were artists and musicians that were my age. And I think the other really beautiful thing about moving to a small town that has just made me a better person overall is that it's harder to find my people, and so. Here I have a much more kind of diverse pool of friends and colleagues than I ever would have had in Portland. And by diverse, I mean some of my best friends are in their 80s some of the partners that my organization works with are, you know, more on the conservative side of the political spectrum. And so I think it just, you know, it's always hard to disagree on things, but I think it just forces us to be more articulate about what we do care about. And I think I'm definitely more so, you know, more outspoken and more courageous about saying what I think when it comes to social justice or feminism here than I ever would have been in Portland, because I just wasn't challenged to figure out why, you know, why I felt that way.
Let's take a break. When we come back, I want to retrace our steps. You grew up in a town of 450?
That's right.
Yeah, 450. That's pretty small. I think that's comparable to where my mother grew up, Hinckley, Utah, out in western Utah. And then you've ended up in a larger small town, 14,000. That's still pretty small. And I want to get into talking about, you quote Wendell Berry. And it's always good to talk about Wendell Berry. Let's do that when we come back. We're talking with Michelle Anderson. She says, "I'm what you might call a homecomer." That's what Wendell Berry calls people who spend some time away, usually to pursue better opportunities in cities, then choose to return to their rural roots. Her recent opinion piece in the New York Times is headlined, "Go Home to Your Quote-Unquote Dying Hometown." More following this. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. My guest for the hour is Michelle Anderson. She's a writer, musician, and arts advocate. She's a rural program director for Springboard for the Arts. That's an economic and community development organization for artists in Minnesota. And she and her husband live in Fergus Falls, Minnesota. Population of 14,000. And I believe in that New York Times article, you said you're set to have a baby soon?
Yes, I'm due sometime in the next 2 weeks.
2 weeks. Wow. Okay. Congratulations and good luck.
Thank you.
That'll be a whole new wrinkle in your life there.
That's right.
Yeah. I want to treat this a little bit later, but just to tease this, you said simply panicking about the death, quote unquote, of rural America gives those of us who care about and live in these places very little to learn or build on. Is there another way to think about it? So we'll talk about that. But I want to take you back. So you grew up in, what's the name of the town? 450 is the population.
It's a town called Dundas, and it's near Northfield, which is a little more known in Minnesota.
Yeah. So tell me about that. That's small.
Yeah, it's tiny. It's one of those towns that's sort of adjacent to a more mid-sized community. So I went to school in Northfield and kind of think of both of them as my hometown. Dundas was, I grew up kind of watching my parents really do everything they could to take care of this, you know, really small little place that they had chosen to raise a family. So my dad was actually the mayor when I was in middle school, and my mom wrote kind of little articles updating the larger area newspaper on whatever was happening in Dundas. So I think that's a really big part of kind of why I'm so passionate about small towns, is just seen them do everything they could to make their community better. My dad, when he was the mayor, he raised money to build a pedestrian bridge that would connect the downtown to our ballpark. He grew trees in our backyard and then would move them to places that were kind of more dilapidated and just kind of beautify any area that he possibly could. So I've always been really inspired just by seeing those acts and kind of how just the smallest gestures of caring about a place can really make a long-term impact.
And I suppose you can care about you care about an urban place. I'm sure that people in the big cities care about their neighborhoods. But it seems like maybe more urgency. This is in a rural place. There are fewer people to care about it. So it's everybody in the same boat. Promotes more community? I don't know.
Yeah, and I think the other thing I love about small towns is that everybody wears several hats, and so whereas it might be somebody's job in an urban place or a city to, like, take care of the trees on a boulevard or whatever, you might not have somebody that's officially, you know, assigned to that role in a small town, and so people kind of have to watch for what needs tending to and what's possible. And I love the fact that, like, especially in those really small towns of just a few hundred people, you could have, like, the mayor is also, like, the local potter who also owns, like, the only restaurant in town or something. So just kind of that cross-sector leadership that is really kind of a buzz in all of community development in both urban and rural places, that really comes naturally to rural people, I think.
So you left your hometown for 50 people to go to college, and that, you know, it's kind of a traditional journey. Was there any other factor? What were your feelings there? Did you want to get out? Did you expect to come back after college and live there?
I wasn't necessarily dying to leave, but I kind of, it was one of those things that it's just this assumed path that most of my classmates were all leaving too, and so it just sort of felt like there weren't any other options except to get out of there. I actually struggled a lot the first few years in Portland. I was very nostalgic for my community, and I felt, you know, a little bit lost in a bigger city, but I'm glad that I did that, did take that path, because I think living in Portland for 11 years really did shape a lot of who I am and gave me experience in nonprofit arts and community organizing, and I think that just kind of building those skills is a gift that I could sort of bring back to a smaller place and apply in ways that felt more true to myself and to the kind of places that I care about. So but if you had told me, halfway through my time in Portland that I would end up moving to Fergus Falls, I would have balked. You know, I would have thought, like, what tragedy would bring me back to Fergus Falls? Because,
right.
And to explain a little more, Fergus Falls obviously is not my hometown, but it's where my grandma grew up, and it's always been kind of a second childhood home. So we would come here for summers and Christmas. It was sort of an advantage to be able to feel like I was moving back to my rural roots, but not quite to my hometown, where I might have a little more just kind of baggage, you know, with having grown up in a place. So I feel like I hit kind of a sweet spot of moving to a place that I have roots in, that my family has kind of a history in, but that was also pretty new to me.
Hmm. I think most of us, you don't have to go back too far. You hit a farmer, right? So I want to talk about your grandfather, and you quote from him, from his journal in the piece. But I think we maybe tend to romanticize what we think that life was. And you you say, I want to quote you, you said as you decided to leave Portland, go to Fergus Falls, "I was a little naive," you said. "I also felt gleefully rebellious. My move felt like sort of a protest against the idea that creative young people need to be in coastal cities. I pictured myself taking dreamy walks on the prairie or cozied up in cafes during blizzards writing. I thought I would learn gardening and canning or how to clean freshly caught fish." And I imagine the reality was a little different than that, was it?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, so I'm a writer and an artist, and so I think that there was a bit of romanticizing about how simple life might be when I came back, and that I could sort of crawl into a little, romantic hole of being an artist and just kind of, having this dreamy, calm life immersed in nature, and maybe learning some skills from my grandparents that that I hadn't had a chance to learn from them. But yeah, as soon as I got here, I just kind of got wrapped up in several pretty urgent local issues, and realized that the community also needs energy and talent and new perspectives to tackle those issues with. And so I just suddenly found myself getting added to different committees and boards, and going to city council meetings, and starting to speak up about all the different issues that the community was dealing with. And so it's actually been an interesting journey to find that balance, because I do want that kind of calm, peaceful life that a rural community can offer you. So the last couple of years have been more intentional, where I'm trying to figure out how I can stay active in the community, but still get to enjoy those things that are rural values, like just, growing your own food and making things and everything. So and I think a lot of folks like me that have chosen to move to a rural place would say the same, is that they get kind of sucked in pretty quickly to all of the different needs that a community has for leaders. So
you quote, I want to get to Wendell Berry here. Of course, think our audience probably knows Wendell Berry, a wonderful writer. Let me just quote a couple of paragraphs from your New York Times piece. You, in 2009 commencement address at Northern Kentucky University, Mr. Berry encouraged students to consider whether they might be better and more responsible citizens if they embraced the concept of homecoming rather than the desire for upward mobility, which turns them, which lures them to places to which they have little connection, to participate in destructive and extractive economy. He even offered a glimpse of what an academic curriculum on homecoming might look like. Questions might address, and if we took the idea seriously. Questions: what has happened here? Yes. What should have happened here? What is here now? What is left of the original natural endowment of this place? And he goes on to offer a vision of, quote, a vital, wakeful society of local communities elegantly adapted to local ecosystem. Did you have, you said when you left Portland, you did have an idea that you wanted to live more sustainably. That was wrapped up in this idea of homecoming for you?
Yeah, I think what I was going through was this transition into my, so I was 29, and what was going on was that there was definitely some challenges happening with my family that made me reflect on why did I need to live 1,500 miles away, and what did that mean in the larger scheme of society and sustainability, like the fact that so many of us are encouraged to venture off to a coastal city or suddenly we're split away from our families, that when things start happening, and in my case, my sister was struggling with mental health issues, and I felt this pull that I needed to be back and be supportive to her and my parents, but here I had, committed to this other life in Portland, and So I was reflecting a lot on just what it meant to spend hundreds of dollars on airline tickets only to be able to, like, helicopter in to lend some support for a few days and then go back to Portland. And so I really was thinking about the role of family and the fact that, not everybody is as lucky as me to have a family that is in a place with these roots And so if I do have those roots and I do have a family that I want to, you know, support and be supported by, what am I doing here 1,500 miles away? And I guess, like, at the time I had just started graduate school in a program, a master's in cultural sustainability. So we were reading things like Wendell Berry and talking a lot just about the idea that sustainability isn't just like how you treat the environment, or but it's also just what your relationship is to the place where you live. And so suddenly things just felt kind of meaningless, and I didn't really see, the world felt very uncertain, and I just kind of saw this kind of bleak future of feeling really separate from what matters and what can help me live a meaningful life and make decisions that are both good for me as a person, but also for the earth. So I don't know. And I think Wendell Berry, like all of his writing, you know, really hits on that. So his words in that commencement address and in some of his poetry were really resonating with me at that time as well. And I just sort of made this intention to find a way to come back home.
I want to return to this idea of community. Wendell Berry uses this phrase, responsible citizens, and perhaps mm-hmm. we can be more responsible citizens if we you know, go home. And this idea of community, what, to you, especially living there in Fergus Falls, what makes a good citizen? What makes a good community?
I think there another thing Wendell Berry writes about in an essay is how we sometimes forget that we all share the same fate. And so I think there's just this awareness of, like, our futures are all wrapped up in one another's. And I think if you are aware and considering that every day in your actions and how you treat people, that in itself is good citizenship. And so I think there's also a kind of generosity that I see more so in rural communities than I did in Portland, just people looking out for each other. And, yeah, I don't know, that's a good question.
I wonder, before we go to another break here, you put your story, you connect it in this piece to what you say is a modest but persistent trend of people in their 30s and 40s taking up residence in small communities, counterweight to high school graduates moving away. That's the story we hear, right? High school graduates, they can't make it. They move away. The rural town's kind of in a death spiral here, but that's not the reality. And you quote some statistics that nationwide rural areas are home to a much smaller part of the American population than they once were. About half of those rural counties are gaining people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so there's, you know, the common narrative of brain drain, and that's where high school students, they kind of flee their rural places, they go off. And they kind of have to, if they want an education, they're going to have to leave to go to university or college. And I think we shouldn't fret about that, and we should be okay with young people needing to leave and go experience other places and interact with other types of people. But there's a researcher here in Minnesota that has been working on examining the trends of what he calls brain gain, and that is where people just like me, when they're starting to kind of hit adulthood and they've been able to kind of get out and experience other places, they start to look back to their rural roots. It might not be their hometown, but it might, just like me, it might be another community of similar size. And so there are a lot of there's a lot of data out there about kind of people in their early 30s choosing to move to smaller places, particularly to raise families or just to be able to be more involved in a community. So I think that we need to look at that whole picture, and even people locally here in the community, I try to, there's a lot of worry about young people leaving, and I try to sort of remind them, like, you know, can we, what if that was just okay, and we accept that, but we also look at what can bring people back after they've had these experiences, and how do we keep them connected while they're away?
Let's take another break. When we come back, I want to talk about challenges. You write about some of the challenges in Fergus Falls. I want to talk about roots. Not all homecomers have roots. You were lucky enough to have those roots, and you say the interstate there bisects the old homestead. You you quote from the journal of your great-great-great-grandfather. Talk about those things and more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. We've reached our last segment with Michelle Anderson. She is a musician, writer, and arts advocate. She's World Program Director for Springboard for the Arts. That's an economic and community development organization in Minnesota. She and her husband live in Fergus Falls, population 14,000. She says, I'm what you might call a homecomer. It's Wendell Berry's term, describing people who've spent some time away from their rural roots and usually to pursue better opportunities in cities and then choose to return to those rural roots. Before we get into your rural roots, Michelle Anderson, do you have friends there in Fergus Falls, acquaintances who maybe have parachuted in, don't have those roots, but decided that they're going to go to a rural area?
Yeah. There's a lot of, I think I want to acknowledge that even though my article was kind of about how we should look at this movement of homecomers, I do want to acknowledge that people come to a community for all kinds of reasons. So we actually have a hospital here that brings people just, you know, for those jobs, and we have a community college. And I think that I definitely have friends that just kind of sort of ended up here for different reasons, whether it was a job or maybe their partner had roots here. And I think that's another good role for the homecomers like me is it can be challenging to kind of get into a community that is so tight-knit. And so I think the people that sort of have one foot in and one foot out, where they know what it's like to leave and come back and to have connections or not, I think we can kind of play that important role of being welcoming and kind of helping people integrate into the community, and particularly not really Fergus Falls, but there's some communities surrounding ours that have pretty significant immigrant populations. And so I think that's also, there's just kind of an interesting continuum of, you have the long timers that have never left, and they play a really important role. You have potentially immigrants that have moved here for jobs. And so who are the citizens that can kind of play that role in the middle to help bridge relationships and kind of poke at some of the tight-knittedness is a good thing sometimes, and then other times it can feel very exclusive and very hard to feel involved or invited. So I think some of us that consider ourselves homecomers really embrace the role of trying to work across those lines, if that makes sense.
Yes, and that resonates. I mean, I experienced those conversations growing up in a small town, and definitely those conversations I know go on here in rural areas in Utah. That the long timers say, well, the people come in for the lifestyle. They come in for the wonderful things that are here in rural parts of Utah, And then they want to set about changing those very things that that make this place so great from the point of view of the long-timers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that's some of the challenges that I referenced in the article. Is, I mean, we're rural communities are in a place right now where we there's a lot to be nostalgic about and to preserve and sustain, but we also need to reimagine what's possible in our communities, because what worked, 50 years ago isn't going to work now. And so that's been, I will admit, that's been really challenging, is, especially since I work for an arts organization, and we really like to challenge the status quo and, you know, tweak and tinker with different systems. And that can be threatening, I think, to people that are just kind of used to things being the same. And so I think just trying to approach that from a place of respect, but also just not be afraid to demonstrate or model other ways. And I'm lucky to have a platform of a nonprofit arts organization that has that is based both in St. Paul and Fergus Falls, so we kind of have this luxury of having dual contexts of our work. I guess just to say that sometimes when you are the person bringing new ideas, it can feel really alienating, or you can actually be invited for a while to different conversations, and then suddenly maybe you're being left out, or so that's been a challenge for myself and for many of my friends that have maybe not been here forever.
I want to talk a little bit, but we talked earlier in the hour about this, but the stereotypes, the perceptions, that all rural America is Trump country, resistant to change, pretty monolithic. And you're saying, and I think on a certain level, we know every town's different, right? There's some complexities.
Yep.
Do you think those stereotypes are still out there? And are you, I don't know, are the journalists still coming in on an anthropological visits? Is the reporting getting more nuanced, do you think?
I think the reporting is getting more nuanced, and I think that is thanks to rural people doing more to tell their own stories. I mean, there's been a really great kind of momentum around different writers, like Sarah Smarsh. I'm a big fan of hers. She just put out the book Heartland, and Art Cullen, who is a newspaper owner in rural Iowa. I think that just the fact that people are taking the time to tell their own stories, and I'm really thankful I had a chance to share mine, we really need, if people are truly interested in the rural story, whether you live in a rural place or an urban place, I think it's so important that we seek out rural voices and the writers that are on the ground sharing what it's really like. And I think in turn that has started to influence, how the larger media talks about it. They still definitely get it wrong, though. I mean, there was an op-ed in the New York Times back in, I think, December that basically said that people should just leave rural places for urban jobs, and there was just no understanding of like why we don't want to leave. We want to stay here. We want to take care of where we live and make it better. I mean, I think it's getting better thanks to organizations like the Daily Yonder. I'm a big fan of them because they're doing really great reporting and data analysis on rural life and economy. So we need all of that.
There is, of course, the big sort as well, that this perception that people are moving to places where they're more comfortable politically. You're saying there's a mix in Fergus Falls, and I guess people are, I don't know if the word is comfortable with it, but that they're, you know, that live together, even with the differences.
Well, yeah, and I think it's, I don't know if I've seen people deliberately moving, at least in my experience. I don't see people moving here because it's more comfortable necessarily. And I think we just have to be careful that, yes, when an election happens, the map of where we live turns a certain color. And I think we have to be really careful that we don't just suddenly, that's the only story, is that, you know, the county where I live is red and there's nothing else to talk about. This region in particular has a history of kind of back to the land movement too, because we have we're in Lakes Country and we're on the prairie, and so there's these pockets of really liberal thinking. It's just that they're the minority when it comes to the voting trends, and so I don't know. I guess I like the challenge of being a little more uncomfortable in this particular like political climate, because I think we can all just do better and learn more from each other that way. And I've had some really amazing conversations with people in my community just about, you know, it's when you live in a, so Fergus Falls is predominantly white, and so it can be really hard to talk about racial justice when there's not a lot of experience with non-white people. And so those conversations are really interesting, because I think people want to do better and understand more. And I'm also really, really interested in just kind of how we raise kids in a community like this, because chances are they are going to go away and go to cities where they're surrounded by people that are not just like them. And so how do we raise them in this place, but, you know, to be good citizens in a multicultural world? So, yeah, I don't know. It's a journey.
Yeah, definitely a journey, yeah. I want to we just have about 2 minutes left, and I want to not neglect your roots. You truly are a homecomer. So you talk about your great-great-great-grandfather, Walter Cook. I'm looking at a picture of him here. Right, sitting upright in his chair, distinguished-looking gentleman. He's a farmer. In fact, you say the interstate, what, I-84, is it?
94.
94. Intersects the old homestead. Tell me just a minute about Walter Cook.
Yeah, he came from England and spent a little bit of time in Canada, brought most of his family. He sailed across Lake Huron with some friends looking for work in the U.S., and he actually almost drowned on his way. They capsized in the middle of the lake, and he saved his life. And then he somehow ended up here. The homestead is about 40 miles north of where I live now. And it wasn't just his homestead, but other sides of my family. The interstate actually goes through three of our homesteads. So I think about that a lot, just how they, you know, they were pretty much forced by the government to give up huge chunks of their land. And so, and now here every day I drive through that, and it's really, it's hard not to think about, you know, how that felt for them to have their land split up like that.
Yeah, that's the heritage that you come back to. Does that, I imagine that must affect you now living back, you know, near the old homestead.
Yeah, and what I'm excited about is, I mean, it's hard because there's not really anybody, there's only a couple of my cousins in my generation that have continued the farming tradition. It's just really hard now. But one thing I'm excited about is that my grandpa on the other side of my family, we've been working with the DNR to convert his farmland into native prairie, and I just think that's really also just symbolic about kind of reimagining rural. And so last spring was the first time that we've been able to see all of the native flowers and plants kind of come to life after, you know, over 100 years of farming. So I think just sort of embracing those, the transition that we're in, feels really exciting to me. And who knows what's next, but I think we just have to keep tinkering with different possibilities and see these transitions as opportunities.
Well, good luck with all of those things. It's been a pleasure to talk to you. Michelle Anderson is a writer, musician, and arts advocate. She's rural program director for Springboard for the Arts there in Minnesota. She and her husband live in Fergus Falls, population 14,000. And you can find her recent op-ed piece, Go Home to Your quote-unquote Dying Hometown, in the New York Times. Michelle Anderson, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening to Access Utah.